Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, we're coming to you from OSCON Live. Simon Phipps is going to join me in a moment. We're going to talk about Open Mirage, where you can run really complex things in a really secure way on lots of little tiny devices. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps. Episode 302, recorded July 23rd, 2014. Open Mirage. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, the projects you may have never heard of, the projects you may be using every day and not heard of, projects you maybe want to download and go play with right after the show, all sorts of projects. This week, like most weeks, I am joined by a wonderful co-host, none other than Simon Phipps. Simon Phipps, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you in person, Randall.
Yeah, yes. Usually we're chatting back and forth and we're on Skype.
Yeah. This is very odd here, actually being able to see you, and but because people may not realize this, there is a Randall just over there.
Yes, and Simon is just over there for me, so we're both in the same room. Oops, where's my camera? There, both in the same room, sitting next to each other, which makes this a little unusual. If sometimes the camera switching is a little odd, it's because our normal technical director John is not doing it. I'm doing all the camera movements today, so let's see how well that works for a good interview. This week we are at OSCON. We're live here at OSCON, and we found a great guest to speak to us here at OSCON, who was actually announcing a new release of their software as of yesterday. So we wanted to get them on. It's about Open Mirage, and we have one of the project leaders, Dr. Anil Madhavapati. I hope that's close. I hope he'll pronounce it better if I made a mistake there. And he's going to come and talk to us. Now, Open Mirage is about, let's read the first paragraph on their webpage, which is really nice. It's a library operating system that constructs unikernels. We'll have to ask what that is, for secure, high-performance network applications across a variety of cloud computing and mobile platforms. That sounds pretty exciting. Sounds very apropos, given that we're all into the cloud. We're all doing lots of things in lots of different platforms. So this is right down the wire, right, what we want to do. Simon, do you have anything to say about this before we bring on the guests?
I've never seen this project before, so this is a learning experience for me. I know what Zen is, and that's about it. So this is going to be very interesting.
Let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Anil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm really excited. I cut my teeth learning Perl from your book, so I'm also going to get an autograph by the time this interview is done.
Wait, the camera's still a little wrong. Oh, well, I'll have to go for a while. Okay, good enough. We'll just use that for a bit here. For those of you that aren't watching the video, you're actually missing out. It's actually pretty exciting here. So wait. Ooh, let's just tighten that down. And I'm just stalling because I am doing this.
That's because I'm really not competent to be doing anything.
There we go. Okay, I think it's a lot closer. We'll just have to use that. Okay, so yeah, welcome to the show, Anil. I gave sort of my view of what it was about. Can you go ahead and sort of fill us in? What's the problem that this is solving?
Yeah, so Mirage is one of these projects that started off curing a little itch that we had when we were building the Zen hypervisor. So I've been working in Zen from the early days, and we had this problem where how do you manage a hypervisor? You have to manage a hypervisor by using an operating system like Linux, and you have to configure Linux, and you have to take care of building all of the tools and things you need on top of that. But if a hypervisor is involved, it's got to be as simple and as reliable as possible to work with. So we started building a new operating system, and the idea is that this operating system collapses the layers of software in the cloud. So instead of requiring a Linux installation with lots of processes and configurations, you just write a little bit of code, and it composites directly into a microkernel that runs directly on the hypervisor. So instead of targeting physical hardware, we're just using the Zen hypervisor as the baseline target for which we compile code. So this way we can eliminate large layers of the software stack that are really just around for legacy reasons. You know, we tend to use Linux in the cloud because it works with physical installations of Linux, and the cloud really makes Linux into an emulation layer for running applications. So why not just try to cut out some of the intervening fat and just see how far we can get. So that's really where Mirage came from. And these days, self-hosting the websites, running up by itself. It survived multiple hacker newsings and such things recently. So it's actually a really nice, usable system for building things that target the cloud.
So how did this get started?
It started, as all things do, over coffee in 2002. Yeah. And I was doing my PhD in functional programming in Cambridge. And we built this really nice set of servers like SSH and DNS all written in a language called Camel. And then when we deploy them, it's frustrating that you deploy these services that are built using this beautiful programming language, and you deploy them on top of a 10 million line kernel that has a whole bunch of, you know, potential security holes and unsafety. And it's also something that's very hard to understand. You know, to learn Linux, it's obviously a very, very important, flexible system, but it's just a lot of it. So we just wanted something a bit simpler that we could comprehend. And then that started the building of all of this stuff that came afterwards. So it's been about 12 years in the making. It doesn't feel like it, but it's been an interesting road of just building all of our little bits of operating system components that we need just for ourselves.
And that's actually one of the things I found that was sort of interesting, is that you've rebuilt essentially the whole TCP stack and everything in this language. Was it OCaml? Is that how you pronounce that?
That's right. The language is called OCaml.
Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so OCaml actually came out of me learning Perl from your book. So I did a ton of coding in PHP and Perl in the late 2000s. So I used to work in a webmill system called Horde and Imp. And after that, it was a beautiful system. It had, you know, millions of users. But I wanted to find something that would do a bit more checking for me at compile time. So the classic problem with these systems is that you deploy them and the bugs show up at runtime afterwards. So OCaml is the systems language that everyone should know and no one does know. It's been around for about 20 years. It's an extremely lightweight system. It does all of its checking at compile time. So you can put in all kinds of abstractions in place. And then when you compile it, they all disappear. So it's not like Java or F-sharp or C-sharp where it preserves all the typing information at runtime. OCaml just gets rid of all of it. And the thing that runs is actually a very Unix-like system. It's just a very, very lightweight runtime. You can get it down to about 10 kilobytes if you're really trying to squeeze it down. And it's got a very simple single-threaded garbage collector. So overall, it proved to be a really nice language for building these lightweight systems in. The other thing about it is that it's also quite academic. So a lot of people use it for building formal proof systems. So on one end, we could build real systems using your DNS servers and stuff. And then on the other end, there's a big community doing mathematical proofs of things. So we just wanted to glue these things together to build much more reliable systems.
So what is the relationship of the of Mirage 2 to Xen? Is it are they all part of the same project, or are you separate from each other?
Right, so we're actually one of the incubator projects in Xen. It's worth giving you a little bit of history about why Xen is important here. If you're building a new operating system, so I work in the systems research group at the University of Cambridge. We build operating systems for breakfast, and 99% of these operating systems just disappear without a trace. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The first one is that you have to support all of the physical hardware in the world, and you have to make sure that your system can actually be deployed and evaluated by a bunch of people. So when Xen came along, it was a breath of fresh air, because Xen is an extremely low-level hypervisor. It just gives you virtualized CPU, memory, and interrupts. It doesn't take care of any device drivers or anything of that nature. So when you're running on top of Xen, Linux is sitting in the background as a domain zero running all the hardware, but the guest operating systems only have to support one bit of hardware. They have to support Xen. They have to support one block device, you know, for storage, one networking device. So when it came to building these experimental systems, all of a sudden, the systems we built could be deployed on Amazon EC2 or Rackspace or anything else running Xen. So this is really what helps us to rebuild everything from scratch. The hypervisor is the new target, the new hardware platform. And it's really important that Xen runs everywhere. So whenever our project became a certain size, we talked to the Xen community. They agreed to sponsor us as an incubator project, and then we escaped from academia and then turned into more of a general open source project with industrial collaborators as well. So it's been a really interesting ride.
So having done all of your work on top of Xen, you're now trying to build something underneath Xen to make it more secure and more stable.
That's right. So the interesting thing about Xen is that something has to manage Xen and all the virtual machines. So the hypervisor itself is a very small amount of code. And you don't actually need to run Linux to run all of the physical device drivers. So in Xen, what you can do is you can run, you can assign all of the physical devices to different domains, different virtual machines. So I can say my storage system is run by one virtual machine, and the networking stack is run by another one, and all of these can reboot independently. So Xen itself is more of a distributed system. It's turning into a microkernel. And the other interesting thing about Xen is that it now supports these devices, ARM devices. And it means that we can now figure out how to target a whole bunch of these backends just from one platform. So I wanted to be able to build my web server, my DNS server, my email servers, and I wanted to compile them all into whatever hardware platform is the most appropriate, be it the cloud, be it embedded systems, be it a Raspberry Pi running in my house, and then just form this nice unified secure network that we could run all of our personal data and services off.
The device is interesting because I typically think of a virtualization environment as being for running a big operating system activity. But by the sound of it, Mirage is very small, and actually Zen is very minimal, as you would hope from the name. Mm-hmm. So you must be able to now do virtualization on embedded devices.
That's right. The secret with embedded devices is that they're actually quite powerful systems these days. So we've gone away from the old 8-bit PIC microcontrollers. This will exist. But boards like this, I'm holding up a Qubi board here, has about a gigabyte of RAM. It's got two cores, and it runs Zen as if it was a normal Linux machine. It's an absolutely incredible piece of hardware. And so when it comes to one of these, this can still run off a micro USB. It's just like the Raspberry Pi. And it means that we can actually just target it as if we targeted any other Zen host. Now, one of the interesting parts of this is the motivation for doing all this. Why would you want to target microkernels running in these embedded devices and cloud devices? And the answer is we're trying to build a distributed system to manage all of our personal data. And the idea here is that if you want to move away from centralized cloud services, then we need a solution that lets us actually host our physical data under our physical control in our houses or in our offices, wherever that is. And part of the challenge there is that the average user does not know how to manage a full-blown computer system. Yeah. It's got to be something that just runs itself. And this is where the minimality of Zen, of Mirage come in. So we want to just be able to deploy these things in people's houses and have them just work and have just enough of a security guarantee that they don't need to be updated every day to protect your data from network exploits and so on. Linux is still there. It's just running in the background. It's not actually being exposed to the end user.
Right. So now, what actually is Mirage?
Right. So so we've got to go back to what an operating system is to figure out what Mirage is. So Zen is what's known as a hypervisor. So it just carves up the hardware and just makes sure that virtual machines can't walk over each other. On the other end of the spectrum, we've got microkernels, things like L4, which is run on billions of mobile phones. And in between these systems is a very obscure way of structuring an operating system that Randall mentioned called library operating systems. Mm-hmm. So in this world, what you do is you take something like Linux and you break it up into a series of libraries, a series of components. And instead of running your application within the kernel, you just link these kernel components to you as if it was just another library. So instead of making a system call to kernel, you just say, well, my entire TCP stack is a library that I can just compile against. And this is what Mirage is. So it's saying we just break up all of the functionality in an operating system, and we just build one application, and we link the kernel components to it, the device drivers and so on. But there's a twist. So MIT's built these things in the late 90s. They're called exokernels from there. In Cambridge, at the real Cambridge, we built these in around the same time in operating system called Nemesis. They're all built in C. And the problem is, whenever you build all these operating system components, you need some abstraction to manipulate them and turn them into something usable. And so we chose this functional programming language because we could take a TCP stack and we could throw it around as a very lightweight abstraction. And we could swap in kernel sockets if we're running in Unix. We could swap in a full TCP IP stack running in Pure Camel. And all of these things can be substituted and manipulated in a much more powerful way.
Wow.
So the twist in Mirage is that the entire thing is written in a Camel from the ground up. Device drivers, TCP stacks, storage stacks. This is why it took a long time to build as well. It's one of the luxuries of being an academic. You can take some time to kind of build these things out, just experiment. And so it means that we can now take these library operating system principles, which came from the 90s, and apply them in this hypervisor world that we live in now. And it's really exciting to see exactly how to push the spectrum of programming language technology with operating systems and just try to glue them together.
We actually have a question from the chat room here that actually I think is apropos to this. And the question from retro_D is, ask about sandboxes and separation between application memory spaces. It may not be appropriate, actually, because if it's all written in OCaml and you can provably show they won't touch each other, I'm probably answering the question for you. But actually, why don't you go ahead and answer question instead of me doing it.
It's a pretty good question. Now, the thing about protection is that you can do this in two ways. As you say, you can just use OCaml and static type safety to protect you at compile time. But ultimately, applications are quite dynamic. For example, if I want to build a multi-user system here, I need to have some hardware protection to help me out here. The key thing in library operating systems is that it exposes all of the hardware protection facilities in software. Mm-hmm. So it means that when I'm compiling my application, I can just say, hey, make this a process or turn this little bit of a function into a process. And so your application can choose which bits of itself it protects with sandboxing technologies. Now, in Linux, normally you're forced into one choice, right? Because you have to use the process model, the threading model, if you want to have shared memory. Here, you just decide exactly how you use the available hardware resource to pull it off at the same time. So there is no one answer. The thing with Mirage, it's just a bunch of libraries, and your application has to make all of the decisions. So for a typical application like a web server, we don't do any sandboxing because we say that for one website, just running a virtual machine that represents the entire stack all the way down to the from the device drivers to the web server. There's no kind of artificial privilege separation because we trust all the code inside the virtual machine. But if I'm building something different, let's say, for example, I've got a database. So we've just announced a new database called Ermin that is part of Mirage. And I want to protect the data from some network traffic just because I might have bugs in my own code. And at this point, Mirage can choose to use two virtual machines, and it can just use virtual machines as its separation point, and you have sandboxing. We just use Zen's built-in mechanisms to protect things from each other. Mm-hmm. But with Mirage, we can also compile stuff into Unix binaries and just run as normal Unix servers that are no different from a normal OCaml application. And then you can just use Docker, Linux containers. There's a whole bunch of technologies there as well. The idea is we just want to write code once and retarget it to different places and just reuse the code as much as possible in whatever sandboxing technology of the future there is at the same time.
That's very interesting. Thank you. Yeah. And so Mirage 2.0, you announced that yesterday. What's new with Mirage 2?
This is the most fun announcement I think I've ever done. Mirage 1, we released it in December after maybe about 6 years worth of hard work. So it was one of those projects you put out there as a prototype. You're kind of thinking no one will care about it. And it is quite obscure. It's an experimental operating system, functional language. You know, it doesn't really hit the popularity points for most systems. We just were overwhelmed by the number of users that came along with interest of using it for something real. And so this Mirage 2 represents a really hard year worth of work just to build out the usability aspects, to build out all the features, to make sure that when you're building a complicated distributed system, you have all of the atoms you need to pull that off. So the biggest headline feature is ARM support. And this is a big deal. So the Zen project has just announced Zen 4.4 was released a few months ago, the first hypervisor with ARM support. And so this means that we're now switching the OpenMirage website to be running as a clustered collection of these running in our houses. So we're doing all the work required to get the DNS servers to point at our home networks so that we could have maybe 6 or 7 of these running, you know, within whoever wants to join our pool. And we're actually going to put this into production as well. So the fact that we can just do embedded programming is a big deal. The second thing that's really exciting is a new database called Ermin. And one of the problems with library operating systems is that you don't really have ambient services available. No, I don't have a kernel to help me out. So it means that if I'm, let's say I want a database, I want to have MySQL, for example, or MariaDB, or you know, whichever one of these is a system you want to run against, you can't do that because it's got to run in a different address space. So Ermin is a lot like SQLite. It just provides you with a library that provides you with a full persistent story, but it doesn't do SQL, it does Git. So instead of using SQL and these high-level languages, we just say, hey, why don't you just put all of your data into a Git store, and then Ermin will take care of serializing that to disk, and then you can interact with that storage through the normal Git command line. So all of our compilation, all of our web service backends, all of that stuff now uses Ermin to say, well, you know, Git is an amazing technology for building open source code. We can use the same thing for data as well. And you can programmatically manipulate all of the Git trees in order to build your eventually consistent systems or your strictly consistent systems at the same time. So that's actually one of the big features is we have a storage story that's, like everything else in Mirage, it's a little bit different. We're just trying to experiment with new abstractions. And we're settling in Git instead of SQL as our fundamental way of storing data. So ARM and Git. And the third thing that's huge is that Hannes Menard and David Kalliper joined the group, and they decided to build a clean slate SSL stack. And this is really exciting because when we started building it at the start of the year, SSL was kind of in trouble. And then this sequence of just incredible exploits came up. So the Heartbeat attacks against SSL. And so our SSL stack is written from the ground up, clean slate, pure OCaml, designed for running in one of these Mirage operating systems. And fingers crossed, we've just put it into beta. We've got a bunch of pen testers attacking it right now. Nice. But it is end-to-end, type safe so far. And we're doing an increasing amount of work to make that more and more resistant to attacks. So it remains to be seen if our SSL stack stands the test of time, but it's just one of the most exciting experiments I think I've done in my academic career is just try to rebuild the entire stack from SSL to device drivers and try to make that something that is resistant to the type of attacks that we've just been assaulted by for the last, ever since we've started putting hosts on the internet, right? It's been a big problem.
I really like that you're actually pen testing it to actually see, because people that do that kind of work do all sorts of weird things that you wouldn't have thought of as a coder, so...
Yeah, you know, it's been really fun working with the pen testers because they managed to crash everything around the SSL stack pretty much within the first day, you know, including the Zen host. We just hadn't configured the environment very well. It was just our internal environment. But the core SSL logic remains unbroken. So this takes time. There's just so many combinations and attacks that are possible. But it's been about 2 weeks. They've been attacking it 24/7 through fuzz testing tools and so on. So we're just holding on. We've got a bottle of champagne waiting for the 1 month mark, and it'll be it.
That's awesome.
But the real test, of course, is we've got to put this stuff to production and just get it out there and wait for the real attackers to come and get us. So
how many users do you have at the moment of the first version?
Right. So the first version, this is something that's really used by early adopters. So Citrix, who maintained the Zen server, the commercial distribution of Zen, it's now an open source project as part of the Linux Foundation as well, are using this to rebuild the Zen tool stack, which is also written in OCaml. And so they've been the first user. Dave Scott from Citrix, who's a chief architect there of Zen server, is now part of the core development team. So, and they've contributed a vast amount of code. And this is one of the biggest benefits of just joining the Linux Foundation was going away from our open source academic model where we just throw stuff out there to getting a proper release cycle and discipline there. And the other really interesting people are Galwa, who are based here in Portland. Just I'm going to see them tomorrow to fund the beer festival. And they and they've been building a ton of really secure systems for kind of military grade protections and so on. Right. And they've been using not only Mirage, but also their own homebrew version, which uses Haskell, called HalVM. And they've been using these in combination to build these incredibly secure managed access control based systems. And so they're actually one of the heaviest users of Mirage so far. And also in, down in Palo Alto, in Menlo Park, SRI International is using it as well to build resilient cloud systems and so on. So the early adopters are all the people who are using it to build very, very secure systems. On the other end of the spectrum, all of the developers, we're shifting our personal homepages to use this stuff as well.
Right.
Yeah, this is just fun because we might as well use it. We have to use our tools to understand what's wrong with them.
But, from the way you described the lightweight use, and particularly the idea of having distributed systems for homes, sounds like you have a lot in common with Freedom Box Foundation.
That's right. That's right. So I'm a huge fan of Freedom Box and all of these efforts. So the background here is that our funding in academia comes from something called the Horizon Project, which was started in 2008 in the UK. With Nottingham, Cambridge, and a number of other hubs to figure out what the future of the cloud is. And we really identified a few problems to do with centralized cloud services. And so we really wanted to figure out how to build a usable system that end users could actually use to distribute data without having to depend on a centralized cloud. And so we have a system called NIMOT, NYMOTE.org, whose entire goal is to give every human on the planet their own DNS name and let you just self-host your infrastructure all the way down to the down to one of these boxes. And the idea is by making the entire thing a free and open software stack, we can actually just unlock the ability of people on the edges to pull this stuff off. So we call this a dust cloud. These are all these tiny microkernels running, hopefully trillions of them on the edges of the network, all coalescing back into the central cloud eventually.
So now we've done, so you're funded from a government grant.
Yeah,
your team.
That's right.
So we should ask governance and licensing questions. So how is all this stuff licensed?
So all of this is licensed. So I'm actually an OpenBSD developer as well. So I just picked the default BSD license, which is actually not the BSD license. OpenBSD uses the ISC license, purely because it was just a few paragraphs shorter. We just wanted the simplest mechanism possible to let people use this under any context.
Right.
So the standard Mirage project is ISC or BSD licensed. Give it away. No advertising clause, of course, as much as possible. Now, joining the Linux Foundation has just given us a more structured governance in terms of team. Because there's a number of contributors that have grown. We've got four core members of the team, Dave Scott, Richard Mortier, Thomas Casanier, and myself. But we're as inclusive as possible. So we've joined the Google Summer of Code. Google kindly just sponsored a whole bunch of projects, open source projects for women. Mindy Preston's been doing an incredible job destroying our TCP stack, trying to find bugs in it. And so we're just weaving together all these people and trying to solve their problems.
Right.
The important thing is that the Mirage project doesn't really have an aim. Its aims are the aims of its developers. It's just a bunch of libraries. It makes no opinions and no prescriptions about what you do with it. And so it's really exciting to find out just the diversity of people, everything from building military-grade systems to people building personal data systems. Anyone who wants a bit of security, a bit of ease of use and understanding, they're all welcome to come aboard.
And so if you're using BSD, you presumably don't need a contributor agreement to participate.
Absolutely not.
And you sound like you're using Git.
Yeah, we use GitHub for everything.
So you've got kind of Git governance.
Git, that's right. We have a Merkle tree of where everything came from. So.
Right. So this all passes the sniff test as being very, very open and very accessible. So do you want it? It sounds like intensely intellectual programming. Using a functional language design. I mean, implementing SSL from scratch doesn't sound like the sort of thing that you're going to have thousands of people around the world wanting to join in with. But do you have a growing community of contributors?
That's right.
And do you want more?
Well, that's a great question as well. So those are two different questions. The first one is we really believe that OCaml and functional programming is the right way to build these systems because it just lifts up the conversation from a very low-level set of abstractions to a higher-level set of questions. And a lot of the people joining are filling in gaps in the ecosystem. So OCaml is clearly not the most popular language in the world. It's very stable. It's been around for a long time, but it's not a breakout language. And so the people who join, for example, to do the SSL stack are incredibly privileged because they have the opportunity to rebuild a stack and learn how it all works from scratch, which is something we rarely have the luxury of doing. Normally, you're thrust into a work environment, you have to deal with some libraries, and you have to interface with whatever other people have done. So the early adopter is just having fun. I mean, right. These people can learn how the internet works. It's great. But the second thing is, do we want more users? And the answer is yes. So I have to shameless plug. Myself, Ron Minsky, and Jason Hickey have just published a book called Real World of Camel. So we really want to promote the use of a camel for actual use in real systems. And Mirage is one good example of how you can use a camel for building systems. It's a good learning experience. And I've also been using this to develop a course in teaching operating systems, because if you want to learn how an operating system works, Linux is obviously the real-world operating system everyone has to use, but it's not the best vehicle for teaching the fundamental concepts behind it.
And so I was just going to ask that, actually. It sounds like you're basically building the Pascal of operating systems.
That's right. Yep. I did a ton of Pascal programming when I was younger. But if you look at the hardware spectrum right now, we have Raspberry Pis, which also came out of Cambridge, and you have operating systems like Mirage. When you put them together, you have a hardware-software stack that is really something that anyone can come along with, not have a decades of legacy, the stuff that we've all learned as we're learning our stuff. If you take a teenager now, they could pick up Mirage and just learn how everything works with a much smaller subset of things. It's worth noting that Camel is actually taught in a lot of universities as well as an undergraduate course. So these people would learn a Camel, but they wouldn't think that it's usable in the real world. So we're trying to just dispel that myth and just say, look, you can use it for real stuff as well.
Yeah, one of the things I kept running into is I've tried about 14 times to start learning Haskell.
Right.
And then I get stuck the moment they mention Monad. I just get really lost with all that. Is a camel have the same problem that at some point I'm going to get stuck? Or
that's a great question. No, we do not. We actually banned uses of the word Monad from this book.
Good.
So it's worth noting that OCaml, so I love Haskell. I've done a ton of Haskell programming as well. The key difference is that OCaml allows mutability. So Haskell's takes a very principled stance, saying that you're not allowed to change a variable and assign it a new value when it's done. OCaml supports this through references. So you can actually write a lot of OCaml code that looks just like C or Perl. It's no different. But when you want to lift up your thinking, you can write it in a more functional style. So it really is a pragmatic approach to building these kind of systems. So I personally use Haskell when I want to play with some very categorical concepts. You know, I have a mathematical model in my head. It is possible to build systems like this in Haskell as well. So HalVM from Galvez one. But I personally just prefer writing code as if it was being executed. So I want a predictable language I can just use to build these systems. And OCaml is that system. I'll give you a copy of the book. I guarantee you there will not be a Monad inside.
You've actually inspired me. I may actually want to learn OCaml now. This is actually good. I might actually get forward and move through to that issue. I'm a street trained programmer. I never went to college. So as soon as they start using big mathematical words, I get lost, so.
Absolutely. So, you know, this is a really good stepping stone to learning Haskell as well, because it separates out the concerns. Functional programming is really all about, you know, first-class functions and the ability to use little data types that you can check at compile time. And these are really separate from the issues of monads and the higher-level abstractions. So Camel just teaches you the basics you need to get started, and then the rest just follows. But it's also just fun, because, you know, there's lots of good tools around OCaml. So you can compile it to JavaScript and build JavaScript websites. You can think of OCaml in a very crude way as a typed version of JavaScript, because when you compile all the types away, the thing you're left with is called the lambda form is just like JavaScript. And so the compilation of JavaScript was a simple, just the optimizations required to pull that off. So it really is just a nice way to program web services and things in addition to building operating systems and so on as well. It's just a language. You can use it for anything you want. And it doesn't get in the way where it all falls.
One of the things I saw in the documentation I was reading is you can actually fire up a new thread or whatever you call those in the time that you're taking in a TCP packet. Can you talk more about that?
That's right. Yes. So the threading model in OCaml, it uses a monad, actually. I couldn't resist. But you never know that it's a monad. It's all hidden away from you. It's the only monad in the operating system. And the reason for this is it uses something called cooperative threading. Whenever you have a task, you just spin up a lightweight thread, just like Erlang, for example, and you can have billions of these threads. They're just data structures in the language, like anything else. Now, whenever you compile one of these lightweight kernels, we call it a unikernel, the whole thing can boot in less than 10 milliseconds. It's extremely fast. And so this means that if I get a packet coming in and I don't have any resources, if I wanted to spin up a full Linux VM, it would take me a matter of seconds to spin this thing up and the connection would be lost. With the unikernel, you just tell Zen, hey, spin me up a new kernel. 10 milliseconds later, it's serving traffic. And without even breaking a sweat, it's just responding to the TCP connection coming in. So this is a form of microelasticity. So if you just want to spin up something with 100 kilobytes of RAM, right, not megabytes, not gigabytes, you can spin one of these things up to handle a single connection. It's awesome. Now, that's not very practical, of course. But, I mean, we're doing this to experiment with what these kind of microelastic models look like, but it, the system is capable of it. And it becomes much more relevant when we're working on embedded systems like the ARM, because you just have fewer resources there to waste at the same time. But we're experimenting with what we call self-scaling services. So we want to build a service that will sit around using just a few kilobytes of RAM. When we get Hacker News, within milliseconds, it should scale out to about 1,000 virtual machines. And then within just seconds of the load dying down, it will just collapse back down again. So that's the kind of elasticity we wanted in Mirage. And that, we're still developing that, but we're using all the libraries in Mirage 2 to pull that off. So
now, are there hosting solutions for this now? Can I rent 1,000 ARM machines and run this code on it?
No, so there's been a number of Raspberry Pi providers. So you can actually get Raspberry Pis hosted. Now, unfortunately, Raspberry Pi doesn't run Zen yet, but we have a backend targeted especially for the Raspberry Pi that Andy Ray from Aberdeen is working on. That'll come out soon, hopefully. But there are no hosting providers for unikernels. It's interesting that Amazon, for example, charges by the hour usually, and we want to charge by the millisecond, right? So there's nothing on the market that comes up with this. But this is also not a commercially pressing problem right now, because unikernels are a very new concept. There's been a few commercial attempts. So I noticed the OSV guys, who are part of the Linux Foundation as well, are building a much bigger heavyweight stack to, that's focused on compatibility. So they want to bring these benefits to existing applications. There's the Erlang and Zen folks who are building this for running Erlang applications, and they have this kind of microelastic model as well. As far as I know, there's no hosting providers out there yet, but it is an opportunity for people to come up with something. Our goal is we want to pack in 1 million virtual machines onto one Zen host. And right now we can do about a few thousand. With the new release of Zen, a lot of the internal constraints have been lifted. So Zen 4.4 supports your billions of interrupts, for example. And so all of these things are slowly being removed from the system. So we're confident that within a couple of years, we should be able to pack in 1 million virtual machines into one host. And the implications of that are staggering. You can have, with complete isolation, unlike Docker and Linux containers, you have the full hypervisor isolation between 1 million tenants running in one host. And that's going to be something that changes the game with personal hosting.
So is this thing production ready? Could I take it down today and actually use it?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends what your definition of production is. So for all of our homepages, the Mirage homepage itself is self-hosted. Mm. What is missing is polish. There's a number of features that we've put together, and it just takes users and time, like most open source software, just to get all the pieces in place. So the Mirage website itself is completely self-hosting. It has been for 3 years. But it, you know, things like logging and all of the infrastructure around that is something we're just building all the time as we do new releases. So it's something that where, imagine it's just an escalator, it's always moving, and you'll just join at some point, you'll find some problems, we'll help you fix them, and then you'll just get on, and the experience will be better for everyone as you go along. But we do have a Hello World thing where you can just log into an Ubuntu box or a Debian box and just do apt-get install a few packages, and everything is just good to go. There's a Hello World tutorial, so... as to whether or not you want to run your nuclear power plant on it, probably not quite yet. Give it a few more releases, but it's definitely getting to the point where we're going to call it production ready.
Does it have the capability of having, say, a self like an experimental box where you could type in OCaml code and run it in a sandboxing mode?
Yeah, so we have a really fun model, which is JavaScript. So JavaScript is a new operating system for learning stuff, right? So you just run it in a browser. So we have an experimental backend called IOCaml, which is a shameless ripoff from IPython, which is a really nice way of just running Python code in the browser. Unlike IPython, we've compiled the entire OCaml compiler into the browser. So because OCaml is written in OCaml, which compiles to JavaScript, so why not, right? And Andy Ray did a lot of this work from Scotland, and he just came along, and you can just literally type in opam is our package manager, opam install iocaml.js, and it will just give you a complete top level in the browser where you can run Mirage code and mess around with a lot of the libraries. So the goal is you can prototype your applications in JavaScript, and the same ML code will just be recompiled into a microkernel. No general-purpose operating systems at all in the way. It's kind of crazy. We can just go straight from browser in a tablet, for example, to ARM running Zen. So we can just cut away the entire middle stack. So iCaml is something that I'm going to blog about in the next few weeks. So if there are listeners interested, just drop me a line. Let me know what do you want to know about. I'll happy to do more.
Yeah, I know the Dart people did that recently. They took the entire Dart compiler and ran it into JavaScript, so now you can type Dart in a window. That's and right. It's really, really
and
awesome.
It's magic being able to do that offline, right? So it's you don't need a backend server to run the code for you.
So it sounds like I'm going to have to learn OCaml, because there's really no way to interact with this without actually writing OCaml code then, right?
Right. So the core of the system is very much designed from the ground up to be OCaml-based, because we use all of the abstractions of OCaml, the module system and so on. But of course, in the real world, you do need to interact with other libraries. So Jeremy Yallop has been running a system called C-Types. And in C-Types, what we do is we can actually interact with normal C code without writing a single line of C. Just write OCaml code that describes the C functions you want to talk to. But then the twist is, instead of just linking directly into your application, we can spin up a different virtual machine to run those function calls in. So if I want to run, for example, not to pick in a library, but OpenSSL, then I don't really want to link in OpenSSL with my OCaml runtime. I just don't trust the code in quite the same way as I trust OCaml. So with our new mechanism for binding foreign functions, you just write some OCaml code to describe OpenSSL, and it's run at arm's length. So normally we worry about the kernel protecting us from each other. Here the hypervisor protects OpenSSL from us and us from OpenSSL. And we leave the readership to figure out which one is more important, because obviously bugs in Mirage could also just take out the SSL stack. And that's a very real possibility. So it's just a matter of establishing sandboxing in just the right way. So we believe in having a core that's type OCaml that has just got one conceptual model, but we do have an FFI Mirage 2 to interact with the outside world. Just don't do it.
So I'm also curious, because you talked about your website being done in OCaml. Is there a templating language behind that, or is it just serving static pages, or how does that look on the other side?
Yeah, so the nice thing is whenever I was doing a lot of Perl and PHP scripting, it's also been nerve-wracking trying to expose code to the outside world, because you're not sure if you've got a CSS exploit of some kind. In this case, the entire thing is just written as an OCaml function. We have a web server library, and the templating functions are just functions that generate HTML and so on. Because in this case, there's nothing. Even if you can exploit something, there's nothing inside the unikernel to exploit once you get in there. It's very hard. But we do have a templating system called Cow, Camel in the web. And the idea there. So one of the cool things with Camel is that you can override the syntax. So I can just say, well, I've got my own little language. I want to write it like HTML, for example. And so Cow just supports you writing HTML directly into OCaml code, or JSON, or XML, or CSS. So our website is written using these syntax extensions that just let you write HTML directly into your ML code. But then that HTML gets compiled into OCaml, which gets compiled into, that's all hidden away by the library, but it's all taken care of.
That sounds pretty awesome. I know that sometimes, I like to have, there's one of the Perl templating languages is Mason, and you can embed Perl directly in there. In fact, the problem with that, though, is that you can embed too much Perl in there. And, the nice thing about Template Toolkit, which is my preferred language now, is that it's once something starts getting to be difficult, that's the time you should be moving that into model code or controller code, yeah.
It's exactly the Mason model as well, except that because it compiles into OCaml types, you can enforce type checking. I can say make sure all tags are closed and make sure they use the right HTML5 model, that kind of stuff. So it's a little bit more type safe than Mason, but it's exactly the right approach. Mm.
So what are you actually talking about here at OSCON?
Oh yeah, so we wanted to talk about our OSCON talk is a bit experimental, because we wanted to get feedback from the community as well to figure out what's going on. And the version control part of this whole thing is the most fascinating aspect of Mirage, in my head anyway, because I can go all the way from building a DNS server to serve my website, all the way down to the websites, the cloud services, and version control everything. So we're running an experiment tomorrow where our entire talk is, of course, written in Mirage. You can go to dex.openmirage.org, and it's all of our slide decks we ever use are built in Mirage there. But we're going to be doing the talk from an ARM device, self-hosted, and we're going to walk the audience through all of the Git workflow for using Travis, continuous integration, Rackspace Cloud, and so on, just to run the services. So there's a 50-50 chance the talk will work. If not, we have fallbacks. But it is a highly experimental talk, just to see if this stuff holds up in the wild. You got to remember, the ARM support is about 2 weeks old. So it's we did it just in time for this. So we're very much putting ourselves out there just to see what will happen. So if you're interested in immutable deployments, version controlling your universe, how the cloud works, our talk will be a lot of fun. Or it'll be a total disaster. We're not entirely sure yet. But there'll be an update tomorrow.
And if people want to begin to get involved here, where's the easiest touch point in the project to get familiar with it? Do you have an on-ramp to your project?
Yeah, the on-ramp, that's a good question. So the on-ramp is not as good as it should have been until Amir Chaudhry joined our project, and he wrote a blog post on going from a Jekyll website to unikernels in about 50 lines of code. So everyone in the project used Jekyll usually for their static templating and stuff. And then he's blogged about how you can just get started with Mirage from scratch in a normal macOS or Ubuntu box and go all the way to a cloud deployment in a few short steps. So that's actually linked from the Mirage website. Just Google for Jekyll to unikernels in 50 lines, and you'll find that as well. And if anyone tries that, it just means you get a static website running your homepage in a full unikernel mode running on EC2 by the end of it. It's pretty cool.
Sounds so. This seems very expansive. That everything in computing is in this module somewhere, and I'm fascinated by that. Every time I ask a question, you say, "Oh, well, we wrote that." Is there really any scope for the work that you're doing here to fit into other projects? Is there any code borrowing, linking that's going to happen outside.
Right. Oh, that's, yeah. So, but when I say me, I mean the wider OCaml community. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to imply it was the
team.
Because one thing we developed as part of this with a company called OCaml Pro and Jane Street, who are a big user of OCaml, is a package manager called OPAM. Mm-hmm. At OPAM, you go to opam.ocaml.org, it gives you all of the OCaml packages available. So one effect that this had was to glue the OCaml community together to give them the equivalent of NPM or Cabal for Haskell. And so we now have about 750 packages in OPAM. It tracks multiple versions. So we've got a total of about 2,500 packages. And so when you talk about Mirage libraries, you can just grab them out of OPAM, just link them in. Remember, everything's a library in the world. So if someone has built a really obscure library for, I don't know, image processing or something, right, in OCaml, you just link that in. As long as it doesn't have any C bindings, it'll work just fine. If it does have C bindings, we've been working with the community to say, do you really need that C binding? Or could you just write that bit of code in OCaml as well? And you know, people have been really responsive in trying to put these things together. So this really represents the efforts of just a small but a very fun community called the OCaml community. And we anticipate that's just going to grow and grow over time.
Right.
And things like this book are out there. And Mirage itself is named Mirage because it should just disappear. It's just a bunch of libraries, nothing else. They're just glued together by a few scripts.
So we're almost out of... find a button here. Oh, boy, this has been a great shutout. TD4. We're almost out of time, so I wondered, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
That's a good question. I mean, one thing we really need is an open source project, particularly one as experimental as us, is just really good candid feedback on things like installation, on-ramps, and so on. Mm-hmm. So if anyone does blog about this stuff or just give it a try, just feel free to drop a line to our developer mailing list, because it really is the most important thing is just get feedback. That's really why we're here at OSCon, putting this stuff out there as well. And also, if you have new use cases and new questions, no question is too basic. Just feel free to ask about it. You got to remember just how academic a lot of this stuff is in terms of using OCaml and so on. So we're really happy to answer questions and try to push it out there for education purposes. So we're thinking of starting a Stack Overflow site and trying to get more users and so on. So just communication is the biggest thing here. Don't be afraid to ask. And we'll hopefully try to be helpful in our answers as well.
Well, this has really been fascinating. I think one other book we ought to mention is the Lyons book for learning Unix. It was back there. So if you start publishing books about the Mirage project, you're really going to be in that realm of teaching people operating systems from the ground up in a language that seems to be pretty interesting for it.
Right. Yeah, I think that O'Reilly's actually been really supportive as well. They published an OCaml book, for example, mm-hmm. And they let us put it free online as well, so you can go to real-world OCaml and it's creatively common as well for free reading. So I think more and more of this kind of educating people about operating systems with a twist, I think, is quite important, because the brute force approach to operating systems just involves lots of code, lots of concepts, and you really want to slice that big mass of concepts down into something a bit more understandable to the average person learning computer science now. Because these things have just become very complicated over the decades. It's our job to make them simpler again, so a new generation of programmers can come and contribute to Linux and BSD and all of the systems that we depend on quite a lot. It's not just the realm of the old fogies that I had hair when I started hacking on.
And it actually just occurred to me, so OSCon Kids Day a couple days ago here, first time they did that, they were programming Raspberry Pis, but I think using Java.
That's right.
So could I program it instead using OCaml?
Yeah, OCaml has great support for Raspberry Pi, fully supports ARM and so on. What I don't like, I guess, is when you program the Raspberry Pi, you want instant feedback. And that's why Python, I'm a huge fan of Python and Perl on the Raspberry Pi, because they give you that REPL, the interactive loop. Java just doesn't have that kind of interactivity, so I just don't like using Java for this. What OCaml does, though, it also has a REPL just like this. You can type in UTOP, and off you go, and you can type in OCaml code. Everything's happening in real time. So I'm a big believer in interactive feedback and trying to get this kind of tussle going between the programmer learning stuff and the actual system trying to stop you from destroying it. And OCaml is just as good as Python or Ruby or Perl for that. I'd stay away from Java, though. I think it's an interesting choice, when it's a very verbose language, right? So it's very hard to get any kind of sense of elegance or simplicity out of Java. It's obviously a good workhorse for building big enterprise systems, but it's not something I teach kids.
I'll have to say, in Haskell's defense, I've gotten about as far in Java trying to understand it as I have in Haskell. So I think it's just at some point, my brain's a Perl brain, okay? It wants Perl with little simple constructs but a lot of flexibility. It doesn't want the rigidness of Java and Haskell and that. Well, maybe OCaml will be different for me. Do you think OCaml is simple enough that you could teach junior high kids at that level?
Yeah, I actually am starting to teach junior high kids in Cambridge. So we have a program called the Sutton Trust, which is all about getting underprivileged kids from a background who normally wouldn't go to university into Cambridge, just to let them experience what's going on. As we teach them Python and little experimental languages, in coming years, we're thinking of teaching them ML. It's worth remembering that the first year undergraduate course in most universities involves one imperative language, like Java or Python, which recently I heard took the crown, and one functional language. And this tends to be either between OCaml or Haskell. Mm-hmm. And so you'd be surprised how many people actually know ML and have just forgotten that it's a relevant, useful system for building building programs. They're just automatically tuned into Java or Python as their default. But I was surprised when we started doing Mirage, a lot of people just knew exactly how OCaml worked. They didn't know the details, but they just picked that up as it went along. Mm. The basic concepts are all there. So any junior high kid learning ML will benefit when they go to university because it's taught as one of their core CS courses.
Well, this has been fascinating, and now I'm going to have to get one of those books from you. There, actually, it's online. I'll just read the online version. Really easy that way. Very, very wonderful. I'm glad. I'm sure this will inspire a lot of people to download this, try it out, play with it, and you'll probably have a lot of new contributors to the organization, which sounds like a lot of fun. Let me try your name one more time.
All right.
Anil Madhava better. I can't read it. Say your name.
Anil Madhavapedi.
He said it better. All right. Thanks for being on the show. So great. That was Anil talking about his project. I'll just cheat and move the camera around here so Simon can get back on the show. And so, Simon, what do you think?
Well, it's all fascinating stuff. You know, I'm very interested to hear about all of the close safety, the very small code. Very interested indeed to see the consistent end-to-end use of the same language and same tools. I think it could be a very, very interesting set of software to use in that cloud of granular computing. You know, I'm very concerned about cloud computing has ended up meaning some centralized system that somebody... I mean, the idea of cloud... which sounds like it is distributed computing, actually meaning a data center somewhere with everything concentrated into it worries me intensely. And breaking out of that is going to need something like a very lightweight hosted operating system. And this is very exciting as potentially the platform on which that liberation of people's computing and data could reside. So I'm very excited by that.
Yeah, I know we've had a number of guests recently on Floss Weekly that have talked about this idea that, well, you know, we went cloud for a while there, and then all of a sudden it's like, wait a second, we don't necessarily want our stuff where, well, I think because of the recent government investigations is part of it, you know, that putting your data somewhere where they have access to the box might not necessarily be the way you want to do. Of course, who's to say they're not snooping the line to your house, so it's right. The same thing that way, but at least having some opportunity that way. But now I'm excited by this. As you heard a few moments ago, I might actually be learning OCaml now. I might actually have to study the language, add something to finally add a functional language to my resume, although I'd argue that Perl is not a dysfunctional language, so therefore it's a functional language. But I'm sure I'm just playing with words there. Anything else, Simon?
No, very interesting stuff. I want to look into it some more. I love the fact that different tasks can be spun up completely separated from each other in a hypervisor. And that's a great security feature as well. I loved him saying that it doesn't matter too much if people can hack into their website, because even once you're in there, there's nothing you can do because the web is running in its own thread, in its own completely isolated virtualized environment. I think that's very interesting as well, and I think that's the direction to go to.
Well, I think you could say it is that if you don't compile a shell in, there's no shell, there's nothing to get to.
Well, there could well be a shell, but Xen is making sure that it looks to you once you hacked in as if there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. You know, you've broken into this place, and there's just an empty room that you've broken into. Because all the stuff that you want to use now you've hacked in is in another room that you can't get into.
Yep.
And I think this is great. I think we've spent decades in a computing environment where the room that you walk into has got all the guns and knives on the wall just waiting to be taken down, and a future where all the weaponry is in some other room once you've broken in is the way we should be going.
You know, I've been thinking about all the recent break-ins to government, even government sites, and I'm sure they're all running some old dated version of Windows or something on their main control computers. And I'm wondering can I envision a future where, by a government mandate, the government has to use something like built on OCaml to as part of their control system, and anything else will be deemed not secure enough.
Yeah, well, certainly I think that there needs to be some thinking about specifying software systems that are suited for the job of being in a massively connected world. You know, we're trying to live a massively connected world using operating systems that were designed for a world where the only wire was the power cord. Yeah. And I think that this is a very important step to take, is to start designing systems that are for the connected world. And this looks like a great candidate.
So. Yeah. I actually just had a flashback. One of my early gigs back, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I was working for Tandem, and they were getting the Trusted Systems Initiative internally, so they would have systems that qualified for Orange Book status. And you got to wonder if the current government's standards required that, we could never use a Windows system. So yeah. How do Windows systems get in places where they have access to the data?
Don't start me talking about that. I wrote an article for Linux Voice magazine recently where I said that I pointed out that Microsoft had intentionally kept security out of the kernel. They didn't use ring zero, ring three separation in the kernel. And that commercial choice is at the root of so much of the insecurity that we live with now. So we need a fresh start.
And this sounds like a great place to do that. Simon, I hear you're running around looking for other conversations that you're having this week.
Yes, so I've been going around with my high-tech broadcast equipment, trying to find people out at OSCON and interviewing them. So I've got a couple in the can now. I've got there's a very interesting project called grassroots.org. That I will be introducing to people in that segment. And I'm out. I stalk the keynote speakers
yes.
At OSCON and try and take a three-minute video with them. So hopefully, all things being equal, we'll have a clip show that we'll be able to put together in a couple of weeks' time from OSCON.
Absolutely. That sounds great. But next week, we actually have, just added to the list, Stephen Pear is going to come on and talk about BitCore, which is a Bitcoin interface written entirely in JavaScript. So you can drop it right into your web app. It sounds really exciting. Most of the rest of Q3 is open, but I've talked to three different guests here, potential guests, and we're just lining up dates for them. Three really, really interesting projects that did. They talked at Ignite. Ignite was an amazing event this year as well, as it always is. So most of Q3 is open. If you can go to twitch.tv/floss, you can see our big spreadsheet there. Link from there, you can see our big spreadsheet of all the guests we're talking to. If you have a project that's on, or it's not on that list, there are projects on the list, I already know about it, but if you have a project that's not on that list and you want to hit them on Floss Weekly, here's how it happens. You email the project leader, have the project leader email me saying, I want to be on Floss Weekly. That's the easiest way for somebody to get on the show. If you just tell me the name of a project, I have to do some research and I don't have a lot of time for the show, so you have to figure it out. So you email project leader emails me, and you're on. That's how simple it gets. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google+. We put announcements there about upcoming guests as we book them, and also the day before announcement to tell who's coming on the next day. That automatically feeds into Floss Weekly, all one word, on Twitter, if you just want to follow it that way. We do have a live chat room. We took a couple questions today from there. We tape this show typically 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. They're on live.twitch.tv. You can follow along and you can watch the show as it happens, including all the behind-the-scenes mistakes that some people here earlier got to see and crazy things as it goes. We also follow me on Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. But more likely, you'll see a lot more stuff from me on Google+, Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. So I already gave next week's show. A lot of shows coming up. We don't know what's happening yet. Well, we will know what's happening by the time it comes around, though. And obviously, they let any fool run this show because I have made a number of good bumbles today. So, hey, this is how it goes. This is Floss Weekly, and we're doing it live. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.